This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo
und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 17th of January. Ta-ta, TikTok. The United States Supreme Court upholds government plans to prevent the Chinese-owned video sharing app being accessed by Americans, possibly from this weekend, on the grounds of national security. Donald Trump is reserving judgment, should the UK ban it too. Israel's security cabinet signs off on the ceasefire deal with Hamas, but the bigger cabinet takes hours of meeting and has yet to vote as I speak. This weekend should mark an end to 15 months of fighting. We'll hear from the family of one hostage preparing to welcome him home. Should mortgage rules be relaxed to boost growth, or are we at risk of repeating past mistakes that crashed much of the global economy? Former Business Secretary Sir Vince Cable joins me. On his final weekend in office, there's debate on Joe Biden's presidency. The actor Joan Plowright has died, she described being married to Laurence Olivier, as a great privilege as well as a bit of a nightmare. How did she manage him and her own career? And Pat Nevin reflects on the footballing giant from Scotland, Dennis Law, who's died at 84. It dates back to Donald Trump's first administration as he locked horns with China. Joe Biden has been attempting to implement it. Today, just 3 days before President Biden leaves office, the Supreme Court said the US government could do it. It is a ban on the widely used video sharing app TikTok, whose Chinese owner ByteDance is, charges Washington, too close to China's communist government in Beijing. In theory, unless TikTok's Chinese owner sells off the app, the ban should take effect this Sunday. However, the Biden administration has indicated that its implementation will be left to the incoming team. And these days, Donald Trump is not so sure he wants to follow through with it. For many people, the app has become their main source of news, entertainment and even revenue. TikTok's reported 170 million users in the US have been reacting to the prospect that soon they may no longer be able to access the app.
OK, major breaking news. I'm nervous recording this one. The Supreme Court has just issued their long-awaited ruling on the TikTok ban.
Things are not looking so good for TikTok right now. The Supreme Court finally ruled this morning on TikTok, and they are upholding it, saying that it is constitutional. I don't like to get into politics, but this is just crazy.
To the US government, I'm never forgiving you for this. And I'm never going to trust you ever again because you just, like that, took away millions of people's income and livelihood. And who does that?
I misspoke. The owner of TikTok is ByteDance. Well, let's go now to San Francisco, the BBC's North America technology correspondent, Lily Jamali. The TikTok has been drawn deeper and deeper into US politics over the last few years because of its Chinese ownership. But how did we get to this stage?
Well, it has been whiplash, starting with, as you mentioned, Donald Trump trying to ban TikTok back in 2020. He has since changed course, saying he wants to keep the platform online. But the concern has long been over national security concerns. TikTok, as you say, is owned by a Chinese company called ByteDance. And the worry is that China's Communist Party could access American user data and potentially use it for intelligence purposes, for espionage, for blackmail, or even manipulate what users see on the platform. And we should be clear here that TikTok has denied allegations that there is that exchange with China. But the issue has festered until finally Congress passed a law in April on a bipartisan basis that was signed by President Biden, giving TikTok the chance to either sell it to a U.S. buyer or face this ban, which we are all bracing for now on Sunday.
The Trump administration comes into office on Monday. All legal lines of defense for TikTok's owner have ended with this judgment from the Supreme Court today. And yet, Mr. Trump's rather sending mixed messages, isn't it? I think he's posted on Truth Social quite recently. Why would I want to ban TikTok?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think he's, since the election, been pretty I would say, supportive of TikTok. He has credited the youth of America, many of whom get their news on TikTok and hang out there, with helping him win re-election in November. And he, at this point, seems very willing, I would say, to strike a deal. He noted that, as you say, he's spoken with President Xi in China, saying it was a very good call and that TikTok was among the topics discussed. So we have all been trying to game out what Donald Trump might do when he takes office on Monday, the day after this law would take effect and therefore this ban, because TikTok has made clear at every step they're not planning to sell it. He could tell his Justice Department not to enforce the law when he takes office. There's also been talk of an executive order to stop the law from taking effect. But the thing with that is he tried that in 2020 when he was on the other side of this debate, when he tried to ban TikTok. It didn't work. The Supreme Court saying he didn't have the authority to approach this issue in that way.
Lily Jamali, our North America business correspondent, live in California. Thank you. Well, if TikTok is blocked in the US, British influencers could lose a significant part of the market for the videos they create, like this woman who has over 500,000 TikTok followers.
My name is Katie Kennedy. I'm a historian and I also use TikTok to post 1 minute funny videos about all the things people want to know about in history. Was Anne of Cleves a minger? Why did Henry VIII have gout? Why did Queen Victoria get with her cousin?
Now, how much of your audience, how many of the users who consume your TikTok videos are in the United States, do you think?
So I've just checked today and it's 33% US, 32% UK. So it's really split. I can see it through the comments. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of the pull, especially for America, is my accent. They've not heard a Northeast accent really. In a lot of the terms that I use a lot of British slang and they're quite intrigued by it. And they love British history, don't they?
What sort of impact do you think these videos have?
You know, I'm guilty for scrolling on TikTok for hours and I come away from it and I'm like, what have I learned? So if people can scroll and they see one of my videos, hopefully they get a little laugh out of it. And if they can learn at least one fact, then I feel I've done my job. And I feel like TikTok does it so well. There's so many educators on TikTok, whether it's science or history or learning new languages. And I think there's so many benefits to TikTok.
Now, the US Supreme Court has said the American government can go ahead and ban TikTok. What would be the impact, do you think, if that ban were to be copied in the UK so that the app could no longer be used by people who are inside the UK?
To me, that's how I got my start, really. I was in my final year of uni. I thought, right, I'll post some history videos and see where it takes us. In a year, I've managed to get a book deal. I've had a book come out in the UK. I've got one coming out in the US, so that's going to be a bit of a problem because it's not out until May. But for a lot of people, like not just myself, it's the new way of discovering new people and it leads on to other things. TikTok, definitely. Kids that are doing GCSEs or they're studying in high school being like, I'm doing my revision by watching your videos, or I wasn't really interested in history, now I'm going to study it for A level. And I get messages all the time being like, I want to apply to do history at uni because of you. Have you got any advice? And I love answering those questions as well.
Casey Kennedy. Well, despite that, some politicians here want the British government to keep in step with American suspicions against Chinese tech companies. Sir Ian Duncan Smith, the former Conservative Party leader and cabinet minister, is among seven parliamentarians who've been sanctioned by the Chinese government. Earlier, I asked him whether a UK ban on TikTok should follow the US one.
I think that all of the governments in the West now need to reconsider their particular relationship with China and these apps that are used. And TikTok is probably the most blatant of this. ByteDance, that owns it, is incredibly close, if not really a singular part, of the state apparatus of China. The national security law of China makes it very clear that every Chinese company is obliged to hand over data as and when demanded by the Chinese security authorities, etc. TikTok is a very successful, very sophisticated system for harvesting data. And so if America has spotted this with this one particular very, very egregious attempt, it surely seems to be relevant to us that we should look to follow suit in due course and head off this data gathering that is taking place blatantly in front of our eyes.
So you would ban it?
We've already banned it for government phones. It seems to me peculiar that you ban it for government phones, but you don't really think it's a threat. It is a threat. If it's a threat, then it needs to be dealt with, whether it's banning or some other way that they plan to do it. But we need to wake up to this threat.
Just on that, ByteDance, you say, is required to send data back to the Chinese government. That company has said in a statement the security concerns are misplaced. TikTok's not available in China. ByteDance is a global company that is not controlled by any government.
That's complete rubbish, and that's a pack of lies. The truth is they know very well that the national security law for Chinese companies is that on demand that data is passed across. And ByteDance is very close to the government over there. Every single company in China operates in a very close relationship with the government. So that is the way it is. The question is really, what do you do about it?
I mean, presumably the kind of data that most TikTok users are sharing is not really data that's going to threaten that UK national security, is it?
Well, you don't know. And you don't know who's doing it. You don't know who's on it. You don't know what job they hold. You don't know what access to other areas they have.
A lot of them are kids, aren't they, in this country?
Well, yeah, but kids grow up. And once you've got them locked on to this sort of process, it's very easy to keep track of what they do, where they go, what kind of work they're in. That's what data harvesting is all about. And with the capacity of the systems they use and the algorithms, they do it very successfully.
And in terms of implementing such a move in this country, how quickly and easily do you think it could be done? And do you think the present government, which has said it, you know, the Chancellor has only just returned from China, very keen as part of the growth agenda to improve economic links with China, is going to be terribly keen to do this?
Well, this is the unknown question. What is the government doing over China? The evidence of how China behaves is very, very apparent. You know, they are committing genocide. They're building just an enormous number of very cheap EVs, and they intend to dump them on the global market, particularly in Europe. They want to do it in the USA and in the UK, of course. And of course, what we are doing, this government, is going almost on bended knee to China in this hope that somehow they're going to deliver them of their difficulties and give them growth. It never happened under the golden era, I have to say. All those great statements about billions that were pouring in never did materialize.
David Cameron period in office.
That never materialized. And the interesting thing about this is America is now talking about tariffs on Chinese goods, which will hit their EVs, and Europe is talking about the same. The one country that will be completely out and undefended would be the UK, unless we do something about it. And it is ironic that at the very time that the EU and the USA are both heading in the same direction when it comes to China, you could say, the UK seems to be heading off in the opposite direction, and I think that would be disastrous for us.
Sir Ian Duncan-Smith, the government told The World Tonight, "We engage with all major social media companies to understand their plans for ensuring the security of UK data and to ensure they meet the high data protection and cybersecurity standards we expect."
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Boards-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 € pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.
Coming up between now and the end of the program.
Bidenomics is about building an economy from the middle out and the bottom up, not the top down.
As President-elect Trump prepares for his inauguration indoors on Monday, we'll examine the legacy of the man who's enjoying his final weekend in the White House and his approach to economics over the last 4 years. But before that, a look at our own economy. The urgent search for growth has prompted the government to ask the Financial Conduct Authority, which regulates financial markets in the UK, to simplify rules on mortgage lending in the hope that the property market can help the British economy out of its sluggish rate of low growth. Danny Maguire lives in Warrington in Cheshire. He told Five Live about some of the challenges he faces as he saves in order to become a property owner.
I'm 34. I'm currently still living at home with parents, or I've moved back in with my parents so I could increase the amount I could save over a shorter period of time. Most mortgage lenders won't lend you more than 3 to 4 times your salary. Now, I'm a little bit better off in the north of England, but if you look down at the south of England, say your salary's, you know, 30,000, 32,000, what, you can only get a mortgage for 90-something thousand? That's not going to get you very far in terms of actually affording a house. So a relaxing of those sorts of rules are quite helpful. And then for people who are renting as well, if they can use the relaxation of rules, actually provide their payment of rent as a kind of, look, I can afford a house, help them with some affordability. That's also a welcome change.
Listening to Danny Maguire is the Liberal Democrat MP Sir Vince Cable. He was business secretary in the Conservative-led coalition government from 2010 to 2015. Welcome to the World Tonight, Sir Vince. What do you make of this suggestion?
Well, there are some practical, sensible suggestions, and they're to be welcome. But I think there are two things that worry me. I mean, the first is that we know from past experience that making mortgages more easily available for first-time buyers adds to demand, pushes up prices, more people get on the housing ladder through these new schemes, and others are forced off because prices have gone up. It doesn't help the availability of housing, and it doesn't help economic growth. And the other factor is that although it's perfectly sensible to get rid of unnecessary bureaucracy, the regulations that were introduced at the time of the financial crisis were done so for a purpose. I mean, it was to safeguard against these extreme boom conditions, which happen from time to time, when house lending, mortgage lending gets out of control and you get a boom that does enormous damage. We're not in that condition at the moment, but it's quite right that there are safeguards to make sure it doesn't happen. To lend 4.5 times an individual or joint earnings income sounds fine maybe under present conditions, but if interest rates rise, if you get a period when people are losing their jobs, it becomes hazardous.
And of course, the period you're talking about, you came into office after the Brown government had to deal with the immediate effect of the global financial crisis in 2008, part of which was driven by too easy mortgages available, including famously the 125% mortgages which were offered by Northern Rock, a bank that no longer exists.
Well, indeed, what is now being proposed is not remotely at that level of extremes. They're talking about making available more 90% mortgages, but the question is how far you go before you start triggering serious risk.
I think you've described it as a kind of tired old idea for growth, that making borrowing easier is a sort of magic bullet. Are you worried that the government perhaps is now at the stage where it's kind of rather grasping at ideas that have been tried before, because perhaps what it was hoping to achieve with its initial approach hasn't worked?
Well, economic growth is very difficult for governments to change, certainly in the short run. We've had a very difficult period since the financial crisis, a whole set of shocks, the collapse of the banking system, Brexit, the Ukraine war, COVID, all of which have damaged the economy and piled up debt. We've now got a growth trend of about 1% a year, which is very low and frustrating for any government. But there aren't any quick solutions. I mean, if you're looking at housing, for example, which this policy is about, you know, we need more trained craftsmen, we need more availability of credit for house builders rather than buyers, we need the availability of cheap land, and that gets to what the government is proposing to do on compulsory purchase and compensation. But these are all difficult things, and they're not going to make spectacular changes, and the measures announced today certainly won't make a great deal of difference.
Sir Vince Cable, former business secretary between 2010 and 2015. Thank you very much for joining us on The World Tonight. Tantalisingly close, but still not quite over the line. The ceasefire deal with Hamas has been approved by Israel's small security cabinet. The full cabinet, though, is still meeting and still debating. Meanwhile, in Gaza, airstrikes continue with many killed since the first announcement of this deal. Imad Kudai is a freelance journalist currently in Khan Yunis in Gaza. He's hoping that he and his family can avoid Israel's bombardments for the remaining 2 days before the ceasefire is due to take effect.
It's a really stressed moment. We are under very big pressure, not because of the ceasefire itself, because until the last moment, there's a huge number of bombs are going to happen, and that's what we have witnessed today in the area that I live in, not so far away, just about maybe hundreds of meters. They have targeted different buildings, and all of them have been destroyed. 8 rockets within 15 minutes today, my area has been destroyed.
Now that you know or hope that there will be a halt to the fighting, I suppose that desire to protect the people you love in this last couple of days must be really acute.
Of course, we're going to try our best in order to secure ourselves. But let me tell you, it's still no safety place in Gaza. So even though my family do not live with each other, each of us is living in another place. My sister is living in the west part of my Khanyunis city while I'm living in the east part. Every time I'm trying to call her to see if there is kind of bomb close to her area. But we hope we won't lose more innocent people here because they deserve to be alive and see life after the ceasefire.
Imad Kudai in Gaza. The families of those Israelis kidnapped on October the 7th, 2023 and held hostage ever since are hoping their loved ones can survive a little longer. Michael Levy's brother, Or, is on the list of the 33 hostages Hamas says it will free once the ceasefire begins. Or was abducted during the attack on the Nova Music Festival. His wife was murdered there. I asked Michael if they knew what condition his brother is in.
We know that he was kidnapped alive and that he wasn't severely injured. The assumption of the IDF is that he's still alive, but other than that, we don't know anything.
What is your feeling and your family's feeling about this ceasefire deal?
That's the thing we've been waiting for. We're happy it's happening, but at the same time, we are still skeptical because we know that Hamas is a terrorist organization and they will do everything to make us miserable. If you remember the last deal, every day was a nightmare for the families. They played with the list. They refused to release hostages that were supposed to be released. At the end, this deal wasn't even finished. We will be completely happy only when we'll see all and the rest of the hostages home.
Have you confronted the possibility in your own mind that you may get back your brother, but he may not be still alive?
I know this is a possibility at the back of my head, but for me, there is no option like this. The only option for him is to come back alive.
Michael Levy talking to me about his brother, Or. Well, Anat Peled writes for the Wall Street Journal. She's in Tel Aviv now. Anat Peled, give us a sense of how unusual it is, firstly, for the cabinet to be meeting at all on a Friday, and then for us to have heard nothing publicly from Benjamin Netanyahu himself so far.
Yes. So right now we're six.
Anat, I think we're going to have to try to
hours.
Oh, there you are. I think we're having problems with the line. We're going to try and reconnect. I think we'll come back to you, Anat. Thanks very much. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of the programme, probably not that particular bit of it, or previous programmes, you can go to BBC Sounds. We can also download the podcast. It is now exactly 28 minutes past 10. You're listening to The World Tonight. One other headline for you this evening. Dame Joan Plowright, a distinguished theatre and film actor, has died at the age of 95. After marrying Laurence Olivier, the first director of the Royal National Theatre, she was in the tricky position of working for the boss, as she explained to Sue McGregor on Radio 4's The Reunion in 2019.
It was sometimes quite a difficult position to be in.
Well, I wondered about
stranded
that.
Stranded between the two of them.
Do you think it affected the parts you were given?
Well, I did have to be very careful, obviously, and so did Larry. And I actually engaged John Dexter as a spy. I asked him to be, when we were all at those meetings about casting, and if Larry sort of put me forward for a part, I would ask John to tell me what other people have said, that she's too old or she's not right, so that I wouldn't be in any trouble with my fellow actors. And sometimes, you know, I'd go into the canteen, I'd go to join people at a table, and they'd all stop talking the minute I arrived.
Because you were Lady Olivier?
Well, no, because, yes.
Dame Joan Plowright talking to Sue McGregor in 2019. Dame Joan has died at the age of 95. Let's go back to Anat Peled from the Wall Street Journal, who's in Tel Aviv for us, and who was telling us, Anat, about how unusual it is to have a cabinet meeting in Israel on a Friday.
Yeah, this is highly unusual. We are 6 hours into this meeting. It's late at night right now. It's after midnight. And usually government meetings just don't happen on a Saturday, which is a day of rest. So, this speaks to the urgency. Mm.
And it also, I suppose, speaks to the difficulty of persuasion that Mr. Netanyahu is to undertake. But this was, in a sense, supposed to be the easiest bit of all of this deal, getting the first phase going.
It is. The second phase is much trickier, but Netanyahu faces some fierce resistance within his own government, including far-right ministers who have said they would quit the government if the deal is implemented. So he is going to have to try to fight off those things. We're not in the room. We don't know exactly if that's what's happening, but he has in recent days sat down with these ministers to try to convince them not to leave the government.
He did lay the groundwork, didn't he, by extending his coalition, by bringing one other significant political player, hoping that presumably would allow him to survive, the government to survive, even if he does lose some on the right.
Yes, he did do this before. He brought in one party from the opposition, shoring up his coalition, but he still faces pressure because he is going to have to try to navigate between, you know, making his government survive and what his negotiators agree to in the negotiations in Doha. And, you know, he's going to have to navigate President-elect Trump, who is probably going to want the ceasefire to continue.
Anat Pellad from the Wall Street Journal, live in Tel Aviv. Thanks very much for talking to The World Tonight.
Oh, who has heard the great commotion, motion, motion, all the country through? It is the ball rolling on for Tippy Canoe and Tyler too. And with him will be little Van, Van, Van as it used.
They might be giants with their version of Tippy Canoe and Tyler too, a campaign song extolling the military successes of one William Harrison, the ninth and shortest-serving president of the United States. Harrison's unhappy end may explain today's decision to move Donald Trump's inauguration on Monday indoors. Mr. Trump, who at 78 will be the oldest man ever sworn in as US president, would otherwise be receiving the oath of office in freezing weather. In 1841, Harrison chose not to wear an overcoat or a hat or even gloves. Later, he developed a cold, then pneumonia, and was dead after 32 days in office. Whether or not the inauguration did for Harrison, you can understand the desire not to take any risks with the health of spectators or indeed that of Mr. Trump. And what of the man he succeeds, the 82-year-old Joe Biden? How will he be remembered? And will what admirers called Bidenomics, an economic approach that Biden would argue prioritises spreading wealth among middle-class Americans rather than waiting for the wealth of those at the top to trickle down to them, come to be better regarded than it has been by the voters? To discuss that, let's hear from Gary Gerstle, who is Emeritus Professor of American History at Cambridge, and Mariana Mazzucato, who is Professor of the Economics of Innovation and Public Value at UCL in London. She also advised the Biden administration on the implementation of the CHIPS and Science Act. Welcome to both professors. I'm going to refer to you, if you don't mind, as Gary and Mariana to save a bit of time during this discussion. Mariana, you actually advised the Biden administration on parts of its economic agenda, but can you first tell us how you would sum it up?
Sure. I mean, the legacy that Biden has is of a president who really created a massive fiscal stimulus. He had the American Rescue Plan, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the CHIPS Act, the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. And we hadn't seen that level of investment basically since Roosevelt. But what was really interesting was the way that it embedded, in terms of the contracts that went out, lots of provisions for inclusive growth, equity issues. For example, the CHIPS Act that you just mentioned was not just a giveaway to semiconductor companies. Those companies had to commit to actually investing in better working conditions, to reinvest profits back into the economy instead of just share buybacks, which is a big phenomenon in the U.S. where companies buy back their own shares to boost stock prices, stock options, and executive pay, which, of course, increases inequality. So Biden tried to combat that by actually creating contracts, a new social contract with business. And unfortunately, it hasn't really been recognized. I mean, the other thing is that it also created growth, it created jobs, especially, not only, but especially in red states, in other words, Trump voting states. So the real question is how come he didn't actually then bear the benefits of this? And Gary, I think that has a lot to do with narratives and lack of communication.
Gary Gerstle, as an historian, I know Biden's admirers would like to equate him with Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Delano Roosevelt's New Deal or Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Will it be looked back on in that way, do you think, or is it not really on the same sort of scale?
Well, he attempted to put it on the same sort of scale. The initiatives that were well described by Maria were on a scale that we haven't seen at least since the 1950s and probably since the 1930s. And Biden was the unexpected messenger who had this transformative vision of the economy, something one would not have expected knowing his prior experience. But in order for him to establish a new political order, for these new policies to be really institutionalized, he needed to win re-election. And here we come to the big divide between him and Roosevelt. If Roosevelt had been defeated in 1936, we would not be remembering him today as a great president or the New Deal as a great accomplishment. This doesn't mean that Bidenomics is dead, but it means that it has suffered a major setback, and it clearly failed to fire the imagination of the American people. Roosevelt was returned to office in 1936 with overwhelming majorities.
Yeah,
I mean, and Biden, of course, went down to defeat.
Indeed. And of course, Roosevelt had the advantage because he did, three and a half terms effectively, being around long enough to be able to claim some of the benefits, political benefits. Biden won't get to do that, but he will also have to endure some of the brickbats about this, won't he, Marianne? I mean, one of the big criticisms is that his approach was inflationary. Do you accept that it played some role in expanding the deficit and making perhaps Americans less concerned about something that in the past many politicians would have been worried about? Now, he's not the only president you can make that accusation against, but is it a fair one?
Well, first of all, inflation was a global phenomenon due to the gas shortage, the Ukraine war. And actually, what's interesting and ironic is that Biden actually combated the inflation better than we did in Europe, definitely better than the UK did. In fact, it was a much more prolonged and higher inflation in the UK than it was in the US. And the irony is, of course, that these tariffs that Trump is promising to introduce will definitely be inflationary due to domestic policy as opposed to international kind of, you know, effects. But I do think, just coming back to the previous point, that again, a mistake I think that was made with Bidenomics is that even though the benefits went to Trump voting red states, you didn't have Democrats there cutting the ribbons. It was often a Republican governor. So they actually didn't get the credit for the, you know, the jobs and the growth that happened with it. But the other point is that whereas Roosevelt did a lot of direct public investments in order to get, for example, the IRA bill through, a lot of those contracts were really based on tax incentives, which are much, you know, much less visible, if you want, to the U.S. population. It's very different from actually building, you know, roads and bridges and the kind of things we had under Roosevelt. So because there was this strong bipartisan kind of war going on, the you know, going indirectly through tax incentives is, in fact, one of the very different ways in which one could compare it to Roosevelt's plan.
Gary Gerstle, the Economist this week, puts forward the argument that in many ways, Mr. Biden advanced priorities that Mr. Trump shared and had often articulated first, not least on infrastructure, arguably on trade, on a much more hostile relationship with which to China. Is there some sense in which Mr. Biden's term can be viewed as actually a less radical departure from Trumponomics than perhaps he would have liked it to be seen as?
Well, as we gain historical perspective, I think we're going to see 2016 as a decisive inflection point in global economics, domestic economics in the United States. And Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left were triggers for that in terms of moving the U.S. out of its neoliberal era in which the market and globalization was thought to conquer everything. Everything had to be left to the market. And there are continuities between Biden and Trump on tariffs, as you noted. Trump talked a lot about infrastructure. He didn't do a thing. The big accomplishment of infrastructure is with Biden, although Trump will now probably reap all the benefits from the investments and innovations that have been made. But I also think that we can expect to see certain continuities between Biden and Trump. It's now clear that the government has to intervene both for national security reasons and for national interest reasons to promote the national and general welfare. So I think we're going to see continuities in some respects between Biden and Trump, and they will begin to be seen as both inaugurating a very different era of domestic and global economics and politics.
Marianne Mazzucato, Professor in the Economics of Innovation and Public Value at University College London, who's also the author of the book Mission Economy, A Moonshot Guide to Changing Capitalism, and Gary Gerstle, Paul Mellon, Professor of American History Emeritus at the University of Cambridge. Thank you both very much for trying to give us some perspective on Joe Biden's economic policy as he prepares to leave office after his single four-year term as US president. The king of the Stretford end, as fellow Man United player Gary Neville called him, Dennis Law, has died at 84. He spent over a decade at Old Trafford, part of Sir Matt Busby's all-conquering side of the 1960s, before signing for their rivals, Manchester City, where he scored the last goal of his career against his old club in the final game of the 1974 season.
Lee pulled across for Law! Dennis has done it! And no elation there at all from Dennis Law.
His fellow Scott Pat Nevin enjoyed a 20-year career in professional football before moving into commentating, and he's with us this evening. Good evening, Pat. Reflections on Dennis Law, both the player and the man, if you would.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, you use the words legend and iconic very freely these days, far too freely. Yeah, you don't have to worry about that in Dennis Law's case in so many ways. I mean, just that little clip you played there, that was his last kick of the ball in professional football. And
what a way to go out.
incredible. You know, a goal that, you know, almost seen Manchester United down. You couldn't have written in a Hollywood movie because he was playing for Manchester City against a team he'd made his big name with. But in legendary in every way. I mean, every time I go to Old Trafford, there's that statue there of Best Charlton and Law. You know, there's a statue of him in Scotland as well. How many people get statues of them twice during their lifetime? He absolutely was a legend in that way. And a great player. I mean, natural goal scorer in every type of goal. But then he turned his thoughts to other things, you know, certainly the punditry. And to do that sort of thing, you know, on television for as long and as well as he did it, you need to be a raconteur, you need to be able to speak well, but you also need to be kind of loved in a way. And he absolutely was very lovable and very likeable, with that twinkle in his eye and smile and the nice little comments that he had as well. It's strange to have a person like that, even both sides of the Manchester divide, who was liked, loved, admired and indeed adored.
He was a competitive player, but not really a competitive personality, if you see the distinction I'm trying to make. I mean, it wasn't all about getting one up on other players, other teams.
A lot of footballers are like that, you know. You have to be kind of, you know, slightly individualist to be a footballer, but also to be a centre forward. But then that disappears for a lot of people when they get off the field. You know, it's just over that white line that they become a different person, and he would do anything to score a goal. Yeah, but you take him off out of that position. And I mean, myself, I've worked with him a few times. He did some great work with charities. It was Football Aid. He was hugely involved in that up in Scotland. In fact, I took his place when he left that. He had his own foundation as well. I remember once doing a dementia event up in Aberdeen, and I was talking to many of the men there, and they weren't remembering a great deal of their recent past, but talked to them about the old days. And as soon as you mentioned Dennis Law, all the eyes lit in the room, and they were all chatting, they all had stories. What they didn't know is that I had Dennis outside. He came in, and there was this most beautiful, fabulous moment, and I wish to this day I would have been able to film it, because the eyes in those men's faces, and they just lit up. They were shocked, they were happy, they were glorious, and they were gleeful. And that's what a lot of people felt about Dennis.
How important do you think he was for football in Scotland?
Well, we do, when you look at certain players through our history, and, you know, obviously Ken Dalglish and him are the two highest goal scorers. But also, to some degree, you have to leave Scotland, you know, to make it in the biggest stages. And there is no, and there certainly was no bigger stage in Manchester United at the time. And remember the history of the club, what the club had gone through. And for the players at that time, and the manager as well, Busby, to take them where he did, not only winning the European Cup, he won the Ballon d'Or himself, as well as league trophies. And he did that all with a style and with an elan. So I can tell you, without anyone's going to argue against it, he is deeply loved and admired in Scotland.
More smiles than tears tonight, by the sound of it, on the passing of Dennis Law. Pat Nevin, thanks so much for joining us. And bring us to our closing headline. The US Supreme Court has upheld a law signed by President Biden banning the social media platform TikTok from this Sunday. Legislation was introduced in response to fears about Chinese control of the app through its parent company, ByteDance. The incoming president, Donald Trump, has said he would make a decision on the issue once he had reviewed the situation. And that's the world tonight and for this week. Thank you very much for your company over the last few days. I'm Sean Lay. Good night and have a lovely weekend.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Wir sind Theresa und
Nemo.
Und deshalb sind wir zu Shopify gewechselt.
Die Plattform, die wir vor Shopify verwendet haben, hat regelmäßig Updates gebraucht, die teilweise dazu geführt haben, dass der Shop nicht funktioniert hat.
Endlich macht unser Nemo-Board-Shop dadurch auch auf den Mobilgeräten eine gute Figur. Und die Illustrationen auf den Boards kommen jetzt viel, viel klarer rüber, was uns ja auch wichtig ist und was unsere Marke auch ausmacht.
Starte deinen Test noch heute für 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/radio.